MacCast, Sunday, April 17th, 2011. Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Hope you had a really nice week. I had a good one myself. We have a lot of great Apple Mac stuff to dive into this week. Apple possibly taking on Netflix. AirPlay has been reverse engineered. Delays in Apple iOS products, at least according to the rumors. A security update, mythical fourth iOS device, and Apple's getting ready to announce their fourth quarter results, and it's looking like they're going to be some good ones. All that along with some advice on securing your stuff on your Mac, a couple of questions, and some product reviews, something we haven't done in a little while on the MacCast. So strap in. It's going to be a really good show. Before I get started, I do want to take a moment thank one of my show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. If you haven't checked it out, Notebook is a really great product for taking all kinds of notes, getting organized, keeping stuff together from all different parts of your Mac. You can do things like clip stuff from the web using their web clippings feature, which is great for doing research. You can pull stuff in from RSS feeds because it all works through Apple's built-in services. So pretty much any Cocoa application you can grab stuff from and put it into your notebooks. You can add in images, PDFs. You can draw on top of those with drawing tools, annotate things, put in flags and stickies. Basically everything that you do in a traditional notebook just on your Mac virtually. And what's great about that is it all gets automatically indexed. They have this really cool feature called the Multidex, which organizes your information automatically in a bunch of different ways. So when you need to get in there and find stuff, you can do that quickly and easily. One that I really like is any links that you put in show up all on a single multi-dex page. So you can find those links quickly and easily. So it's a great way to get everything you want organized in all in one place. If you haven't checked it out, you should head over to their website, circusponies.com. Also, a little while back, they released an iPad version. You can move the files back and forth between those, and they're doing steady updates and enhancements to the iPad version of Circus Ponies, so it's been getting some speed and stability improvements. If you checked it out early, you might want to check it out again. As far as the product for the Mac itself, they do have free trials available on the website, so you can try before you buy, and I think you're really going to like it. So check it out, circusponies.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. A lot of the recent rumor buzz this week surrounding Apple seems to be around what they might be doing in the cloud and with their data center in North Carolina. Jefferies & Company analyst Peter Misk was saying that he believes Apple is preparing to take on Netflix in the video streaming subscription market. Apple reportedly has made a huge purchase of storage, about 12 petabytes of storage to be exact, which is a massive amount of data. So they're going to be storing something very big and a lot of it. And many people are thinking that is video download content. And also, there have been some new pictures of that data center in North Carolina, and it reportedly has already been doubled in size. So it's twice as big. And then add to that this week, a report from Data Center Knowledge that said Apple is getting ready to hire Kevin Timmons, who is a former Microsoft executive, and they're saying he's being hired at Apple to be in charge of the worldwide data center operations, and he will be in a leadership position within Apple. Now, back to what Jefferies & Company analyst Peter Misk was saying about Apple taking on Netflix. One, I think this is an area of the business that Apple just doesn't want to get into. Netflix has a huge lead in the space, and really, couldn't Apple just simply buy Netflix? I started doing the research, and I think their current market cap is around $12, $13 billion. Now, Apple has like $80 billion cash on hand, something astronomical like that. I don't have the exact number in front of me, but I seem to remember something in the $60 to $80 billion range for Apple. So they could just swoop in and buy Netflix and gain that kind of technology. So I really think that what we've been hearing about Apple working on this iTunes locker service makes more sense for what's going on in terms of the data center, in terms of the 12 petabytes of storage that they're putting together. I think Apple still wants to stay in the purchase business. I'm not so sure that they're falling in line with this whole subscription model, although it is working very successfully, obviously, for Netflix in the video space. But I like this idea that I still buy my movies. One of the reasons I don't buy movies on iTunes is, well, it used to be the extras, but now with iTunes extras, I'm looking more at buying my stuff digitally, and I'd really like to do that. But really, storage and archiving and just keeping copies of that is something I don't want to have to deal with. I don't want to have to manage. So if I had a locker, this virtual locker where I make the purchase, I download it, I maybe sync the current movies that I'm watching to my devices, and then when I'm done with them, or you know, I want to sort of put them back on the shelf, I can just delete them from my Mac, knowing they're really in Apple's storeroom in the cloud. And if I want to watch it again, I can restream it because I own it, or I can download another copy again and sync it to my devices if I want to watch that offline. And I think if Apple can do that with videos and movies and music and all that stuff, I think that's going to be a really appealing solution for a lot of people. And I don't know that they have to have their own streaming service. I mean, in a way, we've already got Netflix on the Apple TV and on the iPad and the iOS devices. And if they can get Netflix to just roll in the AirPlay technology so that I can beam that stuff to my television, well, Apple really doesn't need to rebuild that. They don't even need to buy the company. It's already there. It's already on the iOS devices. So I think Apple really wants to build their own solution and their own thing that meets a different need. And that's the need of those of us who want to own certain types of content, but we don't want to have to deal with managing it. And we still want to be able to stream it to our devices and stuff like that. So subtle difference between the two services, but I think it's a significant one. And bottom line is, I don't think Apple wants to compete with Netflix. I don't think that's a business they really want to go after, but we'll have to wait and see. If I were them, I'd just buy them outright and be done with it if that's the direction they wanted to go in. It seems to make a lot more sense. So I'm not sure what these analysts are really thinking when they put this stuff out. Now, as I mentioned, I think AirPlay is a really significant technology in all of this, because the ability to beam this stuff, this content around between different devices, between speaker systems, between televisions, stuff like that, is really powerful. And as I've been playing around with it more and more on my iPad 2 and my iPhone, I am really liking AirPlay, and I'm hoping that all the apps, all the video apps and audio apps and stuff like that start to build this stuff in, because I'm using it in my office to send stuff to my speakers. I'm using it with my Apple TV to send stuff from my iPad to my Apple TV to watch. I think the PBS app just got updated with the AirPlay technology, so I'm really pretty excited about that. And this week we saw AirPlay actually get reverse engineered. So there's a developer, James Laird, and he found a way to crack in. I think he opened up Airport Express and pulled out the ROM and sort of reverse engineered it and found the AirPlay private key, and then released a piece of software called SharePort, which is an open source Airport Express emulator. And that would allow technically third-party AirPlay compatible hardware to be built. Now, it's probably unlikely, because Apple actually has an officially licensed program, so you can license that from Apple. And I think if you didn't, you're probably ripe for a lawsuit from the company. And also, I would imagine that it would be fairly easy. I don't know much about how the technology works, the private key technology, but I would imagine that Apple could just switch things up or change that key at any point. And then if you were using the hacked one, the third-party hardware would break. But still cool to see people getting in and messing around and really pushing the limits of what the AirPlay technology can do. Now, I seem to remember Apple saying that AirPlay was based on an open standard, so I don't know what Apple's layered on top of it to maybe make it proprietary, but I thought it was open to begin with. They do have, like I said, a license program, so I'll have to look into a little bit more what those differences are, but still really cool to see some AirPlay hacking going on. Over the past few years, Apple's been becoming pretty predictable in when they're going to be launching and releasing new hardware. We usually expect new iPhones around this time, early summer, And then we see iPods and stuff in the fall. We get the iPads in the spring. DigiTimes, though, is reporting that LCD suppliers haven't been shifting their lines over to iPhone 5 production. And if we were going to see iPhone 5 hardware this June, they should be doing that about now. So they don't know exactly when they will. DigiTimes is also reporting that the Retina display version of the iPad 3 that was rumored to be coming out this year in the fall is looking unlikely at this point also, based on their checks with suppliers in Asia. As you may or may not know, in terms of the iPhone, Apple usually shows off the hardware at WWDC, which is coming up. We've been hearing rumors that WWDC is going to be all about the software, about showing iOS 5 and OS 10.7 Lion, and that everything is sort of just shifting down. So new iPhone hardware probably in the fall, along with the iPod launch, which would be interesting to see. I'm not sure how Apple would actually balance that, but that could happen. I have to remember all this stuff is really rumors at this point. And then iPad 3s coming out early next year, early in 2012. So if you had been holding out for one of those, you might want to pay attention and see what's going on in the rumor mills, see where they're shifting. But right now it's looking like not seeing an iPad 3. And I think that makes a lot of sense. RBC Capital reported this week that iPad 2 demand is about 40% higher than the iPad 1 demand. This is based on a survey of 2,000 potential iPad 2 buyers. And they also found that Verizon seems to be the preferred carrier, the Verizon iPad, if you're going with the mobile version, mobile network version of the iPad 2. And that higher demand, I think, means that Apple's going to hold on and continue to sell the iPad 2s until that demand sloughs off. That tends to be how Apple sells their products. They ride that wave of demand, and then when it's starting to taper back down, boom, they hit us with a new product, and then demand spikes back up. So Apple is really good at managing that. The iPad in general is really hot right now, so I think they can ride that wave through the end of the year, and there really is no reason for them to rush a new device out to market. Also, the longer they can leave an existing design in the market, the more they stand to make in terms of profit, especially if component costs go down. Now, sometimes for Apple, that might not help because they, as rumors have been saying, tend to lock up components and have long-term contracts and supplies for certain components that go into making these devices. But if they can get to the next cycle of those contracts or renegotiate those things, they could get more profit as component costs go down. So that's a good thing for them. The one thing that might be showing up here pretty soon is the elusive white iPhone. Apple said it was going to ship this spring, and we're starting to see some inklings that that might be happening. We're getting toward the end of spring here, so it should be soon. Bloomberg is reporting that it would be at the end of April, and there's debate on whether or not both carriers in the States, AT&T and Verizon, would get the white versions of the iPhone, or if it would be exclusive to a specific carrier. 9to5 Mac reported that a new SKU showed up in Verizon's inventory system, seeming to indicate that it would be the white iPhone. And then I think there was late this week or this weekend a report from an Italian blog that said April 26th was going to be the release date for the white iPhone 4. So if you've been holding out on a white iPhone, your wait might be finally over. NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters Conference, happened this past week, and Apple finally announced, took the wraps off Final Cut Pro 10. It's been rewritten from the ground up to be 64-bit. It's built on top of Apple's Grand Central Dispatch framework, so it's going to be multi-core, multi-processor aware. We had been hearing in the lead-up from a few video professionals that what they were seeing out of the next version of Final Cut was really blowing them away. And I think that makes sense now that we've gotten some of the specs. It has support for OpenCL, which is going to allow it to take advantage of the graphics processors and the performance that's contained in those high-end GPUs. And it's just packed with new features. Magic Timeline, which is going to help you keep your audio and video tracks linked together when you're editing them in the timeline. There's more editing that now happens in the timeline view. I guess they removed the old viewer that existed in the prior version of Final Cut. Background rendering, which is actually a feature that's coming up to Final Cut Pro from iMovie, believe it or not. That's kind of funny. It's kind of funny. I'm an iMovie user, so I don't know all about all the features that are in Final Cut Pro, but you'll now be able to background render your stuff. So I guess you used to get dialogues that would pop up as you were rendering different effects and video clips and stuff like that. Automatic face detection is also another feature that's coming in from iMovie. That's where it can identify single people in shots, whether it's a close-up or a distant shot or a group shot, something like that. That's a new feature that was added in iMovie. That's going to be making its way into Final Cut Pro, and the ability to identify those shots, like I said, medium, wide shots, close-up shots. They've improved the color management system and correction in Final Cut Pro 10, has a new floating point linear color system. Also, Final Cut Pro, the new version, is going to work resolution independently, includes automatic and non-destructive color balancing, compound clips for video nesting. Not exactly sure what that is, but some of you probably do, those of you who are video professionals, and smart collections for organizing and tagging your clips. So it's going to kind of handle everything, all the way from organizing and getting your clips together, keeping stuff together, doing your color correction, all the way through editing, timeline, and stuff like that. There's some automatic audio cleanup stuff and even more keyboard shortcuts. Apple has a page up on their website if you want to get all the details. Might have to get a video professional on the show to kind of demystify and tell us what all this stuff means. Oh, and probably the biggest news, at least the one that got the most reaction from the crowd at the event, the price. It's going to be distributed through Apple's new App Store, and it's priced at $299. So I think that means that Final Cut Express kind of goes away. Final Cut Pro 10 is just going to be the product to get at $300, and it's going to be available in June. So the long wait is over, and I think video professionals are rejoicing right now. You probably are if you work in that industry. If you've purchased an Apple product in the past couple of years, and let's face it, if you're listening to this show, I know you've purchased an Apple product in the last past few years, then you know that Apple's preferred materials right now are aluminum and glass for making their products, but they may be getting set to change that, at least according to some news that came up this week. Apple has just hired a senior composites engineer, and the guy they hired is a guy named Kevin Kenny. Kevin Kenny, who is president and CEO, or was, I guess, president and CEO of Kestrel Bicycles. He's actually worked with Apple in the past, at least on a consulting basis, because there's a 2009 Apple patent that's credited to Kenny for a reinforced device housing. We also know from a couple other patent applications that Apple's been playing around with different materials, including probably some carbon fiber. They have a 2010 patent for composite laminates from carbon reinforced resin. Now, one theory is that Apple wants to find a case material that offers better radio transparency than aluminum, but they don't want to sacrifice the durability that they get from metal. And carbon fibers being thrown around is one option. The thing is carbon fiber is not 100% radio transparent, but I guess it's a little bit better than what aluminum can offer. Now, carbon fiber is not the only material that Apple has been rumored to be playing around with. If you remember, they bought the licensing for a technology or a material called liquid metal that also supposedly has some better properties for allowing radio transmission and signals to get through the case, but still not giving up some of the structural integrity or the strength of a metal material. So I think while it's fun to speculate when Apple does these hirings exactly what they're up to and to look at patents and things like that, we have to kind of temper that and remember that Apple's always experimenting and playing around with new materials. They're always bringing on talented and smart people to help them with that, and they're always filing patents and trying to protect their intellectual property as much as possible. So there's a lot of this stuff that's never going to come to fruition or never end up in a product, but it certainly is fun to think about, isn't it? This week, we saw some software updates for Mac OS X, iOS, and Safari, and all of the updates were sort of prompted by at least one company, a company called Komodo. You may or may not have heard. They're an SSL certificate company, so a signing authority company, and they actually had somebody compromise their SSL certificates in a way where it could allow for a man-in-the-middle style attack. So Apple was patching that up. They released security update 2011-002 for Mac OS 10.5.8 Leopard and 10.6.7 Snow Leopard. They also updated iOS to iOS 4.3.2 on the Wi-Fi and AT&T iOS devices and to 4.2.7 on Verizon devices to patch the same issue. They also, with 4.3.2, fixed a bug in FaceTime where the video would freeze sometimes or you'd get no video. And they also patched a bug that some users of 3G iPhones on international carrier networks were experiencing where it wouldn't connect to the 3G network. If you are a jailbreaker, you'll be happy to know that just hours after Apple released the 4.3.2 update, which did disable the jailbreaks, they released a tethered jailbreak for iOS 4.3.2. So not ideal because you don't have an untethered jailbreak yet, but at least you have something to go with. And then finally, Apple patched Safari to Safari version 5.0.5, which addressed a couple of other security issues that could lead to an unexpected application termination or arbitrary code execution. They did that along with the patch for the Komodo SSL exploit. So if you somehow missed one or any of those, go ahead and run your software updates either in iTunes or through the system preferences pane, or you can simply head over to apple.com/support and check their download area for those updates. The folks over at Panic, the makers of Transmit, which is my favorite FTP application, were releasing their very first iOS app, an SSH application called Prompt, when Cabell Sasser noticed that there was something odd in the system requirements at the Apple Store, seeming to indicate that Apple may have another iOS device in the works, a fourth mythical iOS device. What he noticed was, along with the iPhone, iPad, and iPod Touch devices as devices that would be compatible with the software, there was something called ix.mac.marketingname, which seemed to be a placeholder for something else. So that immediately kicked off some speculation about a new mystery device, but exactly what that device would be, no one really knew. Guesses were that Apple may be bringing applications to the Apple TV. That's been a rumor that's been out there for a while now, so that could be the Apple TV. Or maybe that it wouldn't be any kind of device at all. It could actually be that Apple's planning on, because of the word Mac in the marketing name, people were speculating Apple planning on bringing iOS support or support for running iOS applications directly on your Mac. One of my biggest fears realized, I don't know if this would be virtualized in sort of a window, almost like the developer tool, the iOS developer tool that lets you test your applications without actually installing them on a device, or if they'd somehow scale up, or better yet, I guess the best implementation would be if Apple provided some way for iOS developers to actually build a desktop sort of viewer version, very similar to doing a universal application that works on the iPhone and the iPad. I guess you'd have a three-way universal application that would work on the iPhone, the iPad, and the Mac desktop and be sized and provide an interface that's appropriate for whatever you happen to be running it on. I think I'd be okay with that. My biggest issue with sort of iOS apps just being ported to the desktop is exactly that. I don't want to see applications that are just ported. I think we've seen a little bit of that already showing up on the App Store, and the experience tends to be not that good on the desktop because these applications were originally designed for a touch interface. They were designed for certain types of controls, and that really doesn't translate without some significant rethinking. But it would help a lot in terms of giving us more software options, and I think could be a good option for developers who want to expand the reach of their applications beyond iOS and move that into the Mac desktop. And judging by the name that kind of showed up there, I think that might be likely what Apple is up to. I don't think they're ready to open up the Apple TV quite yet for applications, although I do think at some point that probably will happen. And then finally, in the news for this week, Apple is gearing up for its second quarter earnings conference call. That's going to happen on April 20th. That's Wednesday, this coming Wednesday at 2 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. And the analysts are already speculating on what we might hear. It's looking like it's going to be a good quarter for Apple, despite the fact that overall PC shipments were down about 1.1% for the quarter. This is at least according to numbers from Gartner and IDC, or preliminary estimates, I guess I should say. Apple's expected to have unit sales for the same period up 18.9% from the prior quarter and up 6.9% year over year. Mike Abramsky at RBC Capital Markets is placing even higher numbers and sales predictions for Apple. He's saying 2 to 3 million iPad 2s sold, and that the total number of iPads he's expecting to hear from Apple for the quarter is at 7 million. Also expecting 17 million iPhones, which would actually beat Apple's previous iPhone quarterly sales record, and also expecting Apple to announce sales of 3.6 million Macs. A lot of that bolstered by the popularity of Apple's new MacBook Air, where he's expecting Apple to announce that they sold 700,000 units for the quarter. So shaping up to be a really good quarter for Apple. They've been booming lately, and they're certainly beating the PC industry averages by a wide margin. So we'll have to wait and hear on Wednesday how the actual numbers turn out. So we're just reaching the end of tax season here in the States. And so I have all of my documents here, all the stuff that I'd been getting ready, a lot of it virtually on my computer. And I had mentioned in the past that I keep all of that stuff in a secure area on my Mac. So I received an email from Richard this week, and he said, I'm wondering how to create a secure area on my Mac to create my tax papers. And he was wondering how I actually did it. He also asked about Dropbox and wanted to know, is Dropbox considered a secure place to keep tax and other sensitive documents? And so, Richard, what I actually do on my Mac to store secure documents is I simply create a secure disk image, a secure sparse image to be exact. And it's pretty easy to do. All you have to do is use Disk Utility. So if you go into your Applications folder under Utilities and launch Disk Utility, and then choose the new image from the toolbar. So just click the new image button, or you can go into the file menu under file, new, and choose new blank disk image. In the dialog that comes up, go ahead and give your disk image a name, and then you need to select from these options. The first one is the size, and what you want to do is you want to pick the largest size you think you'll ever need that storage area to be. So I saw a great tip over on Macworld. They said they typically use a 4.6 gigabyte or the DVD-R option. That way, if you fill it up, if you fill up that disk image, at that point, you could just actually burn a DVD-R and then sort of archive that off and then start over with a new disk image. The reason this is important, as you're going to hear later, is we're going to use a sparse image, which means we can define the size of the thing as being something like 4.6 gigabytes, but we're not going to eat up all that space on our Mac. That's just we're defining the available space ultimately that it'll have, but we're on our Mac, it's only going to actually store or use up as much storage as the amount of data that we have in that disk image. Next thing you want to pick is your format. That's going to be OS X extended journaled. Then an encryption level. 128-bit AES is going to be good for most people. It's the one that's labeled recommended when you pull the dropdown in Disk Utility. So I usually just go with that. If you want to be more secure, you can pick the 256-bit encryption, and that option is available. Then you have the option for partition map. It actually, from what I've read here, doesn't really matter what you pick for this because of this application, the way we're using it. I typically just use GUID, which is the preferred partition map for Intel-based Macs. But you could also maybe select something like the single partition for CD or DVD. I think it really doesn't matter. Image format. This is where you're going to either pick sparse disk image or a sparse bundle disk image. And there's a subtle difference between those two, and it just depends on what you're doing. But sparse images, as I already kind of mentioned, only use as much space as the stuff that's contained within them, but are constrained in terms of the total storage size by whatever size you told it when you defined when the image was created. So you want to make sure you create an image big enough to store the total amount of data that you'll ever want to put inside that image. Now, for that difference between the sparse image and the sparse bundle image, the sparse bundle image was something that was added by Apple with 10.5 Leopard and later. So if you need this disk image to work on Tiger, you're going to have to go with just the sparse image. The sparse bundle image specifically was something that was developed to help Apple better deal with support for Time Machine. And what happens is that the bundle image actually, while it appears as one image to you when you're looking at it on your Mac, it's actually a bunch of little individual 8 megabyte bands. If you actually right click on a sparse bundle disk image and choose the show package contents, you can go in there and you can see these little bands of data. And the reason for that is that Time Machine will see changes to an individual file, and just a sparse bundle just shows up as an individual file. So anytime you were to add data to that, even if it was just a couple K, it's going to have to re-back up the entire disk image. So if you had 500 megabytes in there and you just added 4K to it, it's going to again back up, do a full backup of the full 500 megabyte file. With the bundled image, what it can do is it can just do the little 8 megabyte band that you added the new bit of data to, or you changed the data in. So I would use the sparse image bundle if you're going to be working with 10.5 or later. Anything earlier, you're going to have to go with just simply the sparse image. So once you've made all those options and selections, go ahead and give it a file name and click create. And then at that point, because you picked the encryption being turned on, it's going to prompt you to give a password to encrypt the file or encrypt the disk image. And here you're going to want to make sure that you use a strong password. You can click on the little helper that's there in the dialog box to help you pick a strong password, or use a tool like I do, like 1Password, and really think about not checking the option that says save password in keychain. More on that in a minute. I'll explain why that's less secure. But in essence, if you turn that on, it's designed to make it easier to mount the image when you're logged into your account on your Mac, but it definitely is slightly less secure. So keep that off and just put in a strong password, save it, and then you have your image. Now, to use it, all you have to do is double click on it. That's going to go ahead and mount the image. After you enter your password, it'll prompt you. You need to put in your password that you set when you created the disk image, and then once you have it, it'll be mounted on your desktop, and then you can simply drag files in there, add them to it, and then to secure things back up, you just go ahead and make sure that you eject that disk image in the Finder, and then no one will be able to get in and get at that data unless they actually open up the disk image and enter your password. So nice, safe, secure, and that's where I store all of my sensitive documents, in a disk image. Now, you asked also about Dropbox. Dropbox is a little different. It is secure on their end, and you need to know about that. It's also secure in the transmission. They use SSL encryption when they're transferring the data, and when the data is sitting on their servers up in the cloud, they use 256-bit AES encryption on the files on their server. So it's protected on their servers. It's protected in transfer. The problem is that it's not protected on your end, because the way Dropbox works is it just sets up a folder inside your home folder. That folder is not encrypted or protected locally, so there's no data protection there. What you could do is create the disk image like I just described using Disk Utility, and then put that on your Dropbox if you need to sync that between different Macs and things like that. What I have read, though, is there are some concerns that if you mount that encrypted disk image on multiple Macs at the same time, on two different systems at the same time, there could be some issues in potential file corruption. I hadn't been able to figure out verification on that, but just something to be aware of if you're going to use that method. So I would only have that encrypted disk image open if you're storing it on Dropbox on one machine at a time. But you know, you can't rely on Dropbox security in the cloud being secure on your Mac. You have to take responsibility for that yourself. And that brings me to my final point in all of this, which is the weakest link. You are the weakest link in your security. Well, you and your password. So a couple things you want to make sure that you do on your Mac is, one, you require a password when you boot up your Mac, and also log out of your account when you walk away from your Mac, or at least require a password to wake your Mac from sleep. So if you go into the system preferences under security, you can set that up. And then also make sure you set a short sleep time in Energy Saver so that your Mac goes to sleep relatively quickly should you walk away. Because if you walk away from your Mac and you have this encrypted disk image already mounted, someone could walk up to your machine and they get access to your files because it's already there. You're logged into your account. So this is all controlled by the account login. And again, make sure that you don't store the password in your keychain, because once you're logged in and your keychain's been enabled, someone could double click on that disk image if you stored the password in there, and the image will just mount. It's not going to prompt for the password, so they'll be able to get past that security. So I wouldn't store the secure disk image password in the keychain. If you absolutely have to, like I said, make sure you turn on the system preferences security to require a password when your Mac goes to sleep, and anytime you walk away, make sure you put your Mac to sleep or actually log out of your account, and that way they won't be able to bypass that security. Last thing, though, is make sure that you're using secure passwords. And that means very long passwords, 12, 14, 16 characters or longer, combinations of numbers and letters, no dictionary words, use special characters. That's why I'm a 1Password user. 1Password will create really strong, secure passwords for you. It will store them, it'll keep track of them, and all you have to do is remember one secure password, that 1Password, and that will get you access to all of the other passwords that you need. It's a really great piece of software, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes. I know there's some other tools out there. Whatever tool you use to create secure passwords, just make sure you do that, and make sure you're not using the same password on every account. I learned this lesson the hard way. I got hacked. Never again. Switched over to 1Password and I've never looked back, and it was a great decision, let me tell you, because some other incidents have come up since, and I have peace of mind. I don't worry about it. I go, oh, well, that's that one account. I'll just go fix the password on that account. I don't have to worry about any of my other accounts and things like that. So, you know, when these reports come out that this system got hacked and so-and-so's data got scraped, or a hacker broke in and stole the database with all the passwords for ABC company, you know, insert big name web hosting company here, I don't panic. I just go change my password for that one account, and I'm good to go. The other option in all of this that a lot of people choose to use is partial or whole disk encryption. So a couple different options. Apple has a built-in technology within the security and the system preferences called File Vault. File Vault actually encrypts the entire user folder, your entire home folder, and all of the stuff inside that. And it'll do that when you're logged out of your account or your Mac is shut down. The other option is doing a whole disk encryption using something like PGP whole disk encryption. This was recently bought by Norton, and I hadn't checked it out in a while. I've heard great things about PGP whole disk encryption. I have some friends who use it and swear by it. They think it's an absolutely great product. I've never tried it myself. But I went to Norton to try and find the information on pricing and what they're doing with it. And it, unfortunately, like I think a lot of things with Norton, it was kind of messed up. I could only find it under their business section. I thought they had a home version. So I'm really confused on that. If anybody is using PGP whole disk encryption and has been since Norton bought it, please give me an update. Let me know if it's still working, if they've messed it up, or if it's still a good product. But There's some others out there. I think TrueCrypt, which is a open source one, might have some options for at least doing the partial, if not whole disk encryption. And I think there are some other solutions out there. So if you're really concerned about security, you could encrypt your whole entire hard drive, and you have some options for that. So that might be worth looking into. Hope that helps you out, Richard, and answers your question. If you're like me and you're a MobileMe subscriber, you have come to heavily rely on your MobileMe account specifically for syncing your contacts and your calendars and bookmarks and other data. Apple is moving its whole calendar system over to on MobileMe over to a new CalDAV server system where the master version of your calendar sits in the cloud. Prior to this update, Apple used something called Sync Services, and that change over is has started. You were able to opt into it for a while now. If you haven't switched over, you might consider, because Apple's actually going to switch over everyone on May 5th, 2011. And I received this question from Andrew about the MobileMe calendar switch.
Hi, Adam. This is Andy with a question about the new MobileMe calendar switchover. Recently updated our iMacs to switch over to using the MobileMe calendar using the CalDAV syncing, and seemed to go pretty smooth. Did a backup of the iCal archive before I did that. But now, recently, I've been hearing comments like from Matt Geek Gab that they said once you update your MobileMe calendar, you no longer should have your MobileMe calendar checkbox synced in the syncing tab of the system preferences pane for MobileMe. I've left it checked, and I don't seem to see any problems with that. And I was just wondering if you'd heard anything about whether or not that really should get unchecked, because nothing in the Apple instructions for updating to the new MobileMe calendar seemed to mention unchecking that in the system preferences once you had finished, because apparently the CalDAV just is over the air syncing with MobileMe, and you don't really need to sync through the syncing services with the system preferences. But I'm not seeing any problems, and I'm kind of thinking, if it's not broke, don't fix it. Have you heard anything about that? Have you done the calendar upgrade? And what are your thinking or your thoughts on that? Appreciate any comments. Talk to you later.
Hey, Andy. Yep. So I, as I mentioned, I switched over already, and I actually have the sync checkbox still checked in my system preferences, and I had it when I received your voicemail. And I actually contacted Dave over at Mac Geek Gab and asked him this question directly, because I wasn't really sure. And you're right, there aren't anything in Apple's instructions, but and also I agree with you. I typically take the stance of it, if it isn't broke, don't try and fix it. But Dave made a good case, and I ended up unchecking mine, and here's why. You're right. You don't need sync services anymore for iCal. It's all going to happen through the new cloud-based CalDAV. So when you launch iCal, that's actually when it's going to go out to the cloud, and it's going to sync up your data. It's not happening through sync services in the background. And that is a significant change. And to Dave's point, he said, well, you know, unchecking it is going to serve as a good reminder that that's no longer the place that we sync our calendars. So just from that standpoint, it's a good thing to do. The other thing is if you have other third-party applications that are relying on iCal sync services, those aren't really going to work anymore. And one I had noticed, and I didn't really know why until you sent me this message, is I use BusyCal, and I also use some other tools or third-party tools that update my iCal database locally. The calendar store framework is specifically what it's called locally. And the strange thing that was happening was that I would do those things. I would update my calendar, and those updates wouldn't show up in BusyCal. They wouldn't show up in BusyCal until I actually launched iCal. And the reason for that is I switched my BusyCal over to use the new CalDAV server, meaning that when I launch BusyCal, it goes out to the cloud and it looks for those updates. It's no longer looking for those updates locally. So we need that reminder that this calendar syncing system has actually changed, And a good reminder of that is just to uncheck that in the syncing services. And also, if you have third-party apps that rely on those syncing services, those things are going to also break when you uncheck that box, or in theory should break when you uncheck that box. And that will serve as your reminder to go out and either update those applications or talk to the developer, find some other workaround to get that functionality. And you can do that now and have some time to deal with it before the May 5th switchover, at which point it's going to be forced upon you. So take the time now, get ready for the switchover, sort of what Apple's saying, and that was Dave's point, and I totally agree with him. So that's what's going on with the iCal, and you probably do want to go ahead and just uncheck that. So I tend not to do a lot of product reviews on the MacCast. Occasionally I'll have you send me something, and it's a cool review of a product that you've discovered. I have an opportunity every once in a while to get some cool products from some vendors and check them out and play around with them. And so this week I thought I'd talk to you about one that I received a couple weeks ago called the iMango X. iMango X, not Mango, sounded like Mango. iMango X from Portable Sound Laboratories. This is a portable speaker system that can be used, well, really with anything that has an eighth inch mini jack, but you're probably going to use it with your iPhone or your iPod. Those are the most likely choices. But there's also some options if you want to use it with an iPad, which is one of the things that makes it really cool. It's about the size of maybe two and a half external hard drives stacked together, if you can imagine that. So fairly portable, not micro small, but definitely portable. And it has a little bit of heft and weight to it, but not overly heavy. You can certainly, you know, throw it in a bag or take it with you. And the way it works is it has the speakers on the front, and then in the back, there's sort of a device compartment. So you unzip the thing, and it clamshells open. And in the back, there's a little compartment where you can put your device. Like I mentioned, it has a little eighth-inch mini jack that plugs into the headphone jack on your device. And then there's a clear window that you can access your controls from. And behind that is some high-density memory foam, and there's different inserts of different thicknesses depending on your device, and you sort of sandwich it in there, and then you close the whole thing up, you zip it up, and then there is a power button on the front. You can turn the power on and then start playing your device. And the speakers, I have to tell you, sound really great. They're 37 millimeter speakers with a ported bass. The iMango X, one of the features of it is that it has a rechargeable lithium-ion battery. The company says it lasts up to 12 hours. I hadn't really tested the full battery life, but the battery is replaceable, and you can get extra batteries. So if you need more than 12 hours, you can certainly do that. I have to say the sound that I got from it was great. It sounds really clean. The amplifier is really nice. Can definitely fill a small room with sound very well. And then on the front, it has a number of ports. It actually has two headphone jacks. So if you want to listen to music in private and you want to have two people listening at the same time, you can do that. It has a dual mic and auxiliary in port. And that's cool because that means you can actually connect in additional devices, including something like an iPad. So if you wanted to play your iPad through these speakers, that'd be good for that, and just use it as a portable speaker system. You don't have to stick your device inside the unit itself if you don't want. And then there is a power port for recharging the internal lithium ion battery. And you can actually daisy chain multiple iMango X's together. So if you want to have two or three or four or five of these things all together, all playing the music from one device, you can do that. It's really well built, sounds great. It seems very rugged to me. The whole enclosure is wrapped in sort of a neoprene. So it's a hard case wrapped in neoprene. It would probably protect your device pretty well. They say the neoprene is actually water resistant. I don't think you'd want to submerge the thing, but it should be okay if it got a little bit wet. So that would make it probably great for the beach, going camping. The one thing I am concerned about is the bass ports are just open holes in the front, so you probably want to avoid getting any material in there. I don't think you want to throw it directly down on the sand, but if you put it on your towel and we're just listening to music, you'd probably be okay. Overall, in using it for a week or two, I was very impressed by the unit. The sound was really great, and I think that's the most ideal thing when you're looking at a portable system, and you can really get some good volume out of it. The only minor issues that I had were that with some devices, when they're in the case, you can't access any controls that aren't on the front of the device. So like the sleep wake button on your iPhone or your iPod Touch, you're not going to be able to get to that to turn it off without opening the case or the enclosure. If you have one of the new iPod Nanos where the volume controls are actually on the top of the device, you're not going to be able to get to those. You could use the external auxiliary port for that, but then you are going to need to get your own 1/8 inch to 1/8 inch cable to hook that up with. As I already mentioned, dirt might be an issue also inside the case because, as I mentioned, when you put your device in there, you sort of sandwich it between this clear plastic that gives you access to the controls and the back plate. And if you were to get dirt or dust, and I actually had at one point where a little piece of sand got in between my iPhone screen and the case. And so as I was using the controls, I could feel that little grain of sand. So you want to keep that area clean, I would imagine, so that you don't scratch up your device. Accessing the controls through the plastic window worked, but it was a little bit more awkward than if I were just, you know, touching the device directly. The base ports are open, as I mentioned, so you might worry about dust and dirt getting in there. And then the only other thing that was strange is while there is a power button on the front of the unit to turn it on and off, there's also an on-off switch by the battery itself on the inside next to the battery compartment. And I left that on and just simply powered the unit off from the outside. And when I came back a day or two later, the battery was actually drained, even though I wasn't using the unit. So from that point forward, I always made sure to turn off the internal switch, and then the battery lasted as I went to use it. So I'm not sure why there's a discrepancy between those two switches, but just something to note in the operation that was a little bit confusing. So a few very minor complaints there. Overall, I was really impressed. I think the sound is the big thing that sets this apart, and also the price. $69.95 for the unit. So not bad at all for a really nice sounding portable speaker system for your iOS devices. If you want additional batteries, those will run you $19.95 US. And if you want to check it out, I will have links to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But there you have it, the iMango X. So there's a review from me. How about a review from you? If you have a new iPad 2, one thing you might be concerned about, and I've been a little bit concerned about this myself, is the back of the unit. You have the new smart cover, possibly, but there's nothing on the back, and skin might be right up your alley. It was something that George ran across. He found one that he really liked, so take a listen.
Hi, Adam. This is George, and I've got a review for you. I just bought a Skinomi Tech Skin, which is a clear film skin protector for the back of my new iPad 2. I installed it just a couple days ago, and the installation went perfectly and easily. And even though my cat got in the way, there was no mishaps, no problems. And now I feel that the aluminum back of the iPad is protected. I do have the Apple cover, but that only protects the front. And I think the glass on the front is pretty rugged. With the back of it, you know, aluminum, it'll scratch and scuff pretty easily. So now it has this nice, glossy polyurethane, a clear plastic protector on there that adds no weight and no thickness. Skinomi also included a plastic to place on the front of the iPad. I'm not going to put that on there. I think it probably would reduce the sensitivity and the brightness. And with the glass cover, I'm just thinking maybe it doesn't need that extra protection. Maybe you have a thought on that. I don't know if one of your iPads has ever had a cracked glass. But anyway, this is George. I posted a video on YouTube, and it has the installation on there. It's a 3-minute video. And you or your listeners could take a look at that if you'd like to. Have a great day. Love the MacCast. Bye.
Hey, George, thanks. Appreciate the review, and I will have a link to George's installation video in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to check that out. But to answer your question, yeah, I have used skins on my devices before, both on the front and the back. I'm kind of partial to the ones from Zag, the Invisible Shield. I really like those. I have to say, having one on the front, it's a little bit of a catch-22 because I like the protection it affords. I actually have some scratches on the glass of my iPhone 4, just real minor ones. Most people wouldn't even really notice them. I notice them because I'm a stickler about that sort of stuff, and I would imagine many of you are also. So if you really want to keep your devices protected, you might consider a skin. It does sort of change the feel as you're scrolling and stuff like that. And depending on the type of person you are, you may or may not be able to put up with that. I ultimately decided I didn't like it enough to want the protection. So I generally don't put skins on the front of my devices. Although I did find some nice anti-glare ones at Macworld that I might give a try. And if I do that, I'll be sure to review those on a future episode of the MacCast. As far as the back of the devices go, I'm definitely considering one for my iPad. One that I really liked, although there's no iPad 2 version yet, is also from Zag. I saw them at Macworld. They have some leather skins that add a really nice look to the device. What I really liked about the leather skins, they're a little bit thicker, so I'm not sure how they would go with cases, and I'm not sure if they'd totally work with Apple's new smart cover. I'm hoping that Zag would account for that and allow you to use the smart cover with their leather skin on the back, but really nice high-end look to the leather skins. You can pick them up for the old iPads. I think they're on sale for about half off right now. So if you want to check those out, I'll have a link to those in the show notes at maccast.com as well. And then I've also heard good things about Jella skins. I know a lot of people who use Jella skins and swear by them. They do have iPad 2 designs. And what's cool about Jella skins is they have designs from all kinds of different artists. So you can sort of browse through their stock designs, but also you can upload your own custom designs. So if you have a photo that you want to have on the back of your iPad as a skin, or you do your own artwork and want to have your own drawings, you can do that through jellaskins.com. So lots of different options for protection for the back of your iPad. Now, all of that said, and even though I'm considering one for the back of my iPad 2, I have had my iPad 2 since launch day, and I've had nothing on the back. And every other Apple product that I've ever had that's been aluminum is exactly like you mentioned, George. It gets scuffed, it gets scratched, it gets banged up. The Apple logo, the plastic acrylic Apple logo on the back gets scratched up. I've had my iPad 2, and I have not babied it. I'm delicate with my devices, but I definitely don't baby them. I slide them in and out of cases and bags. I put them on top of tables. The back of my iPad 2, for whatever reason, and I'm going to knock on wood here because I don't want to jinx things, but has not scratched. It looks like it did the day I bought it, and I don't know what Apple has done to this case that's different, but I'm definitely noticing the wear level. It seems much more rugged and much more durable. You're right about the glass. I think they're using the Dragon Tail glass, which we've seen some videos on. Incredibly flexible, incredibly durable. So I think Apple's gone a long way to make the iPad 2 a much more rugged device, even though it's thinner and a little bit lighter. So amazing technology in there. I don't know if I'll get a skin or not, but I certainly appreciate you sending in your review. So there's one more thing I want to talk to you about today. And this came up because as I was doing research for the show, I go through my RSS feed, I go through my news feed, and I'm noticing more and more that I'll come across an article that will reference a piece of software or a piece of music or a movie, something that is available in one of Apple's stores, be it the App Store or the iTunes Store. And they will have a direct link to iTunes. And if it's something that I'm interested in, I'll click on that link. And whether I'm on my iOS device or whether I'm on my desktop, it'll launch to the appropriate store, go right to the thing that I was interested in. And right there is the buy button. And if I'm logged into my account, clicking that buy button means that I will purchase that thing immediately. And I've done that. I will admit to you, I've done that, and I've done that multiple times. And what that got me thinking about is something that is, I think, unique to Apple, at least as far as I can tell. I can't think of any other service that has this, maybe Amazon, but the ability to be reading through an RSS feed or looking at something on a device, and I'm going to call it the two-click purchase, the power of the two-click software or media purchase. And this is something that can happen with iOS anytime, anywhere now. And I think this is something that Apple's competition really can't replicate. Again, with maybe the exception of Amazon, but I don't even know that Amazon has something like this on the Kindle, or I don't know on third-party devices. If I click an Amazon link, is it going to launch the Amazon app on my mobile device or my tablet or my smartphone? I don't know that they have that working or have that happening yet, but I could be wrong. But clicking that, I am two clicks away from making a purchase at any point in time on any one of my devices, be it my Mac or my iOS device. And that is a powerful thing. The MLB.com CEO in an interview also mentioned that iOS owners are more likely, at least according to their research, are more likely to buy content. Now, he was referring to subscription content because they sell subscription baseball content. But I've seen in other reports that this behavior sort of translates to app purchases as well, or on purchases in Apple's stores, that iOS device owners and Apple owners are more likely to buy software and buy applications than people on other platforms, specifically Android in most cases. But this is also why I think when we see numbers of how many paid apps are in the App Store from a percentage standpoint, how many paid apps are in the Apple's App Store versus some of the other app stores when compared to free applications, the paid app percentage is higher on Apple's App Store. And I think we're now back to the thing that I keep coming back to, which is this market share versus profit share debate, and where do developers want to be when they're looking at developing for these different platforms. I think ultimately Android is going to have the larger market share, but where is the profit center for developers? And it's things like this quick two-click purchase. It makes it very easy for me to buy a developer's app. I'm reading a review of that app on somebody's blog. Click, click, I've now bought their application. And there's a lot of power in that. And I think that's something that Apple's competition is missing out on. That I can make that spontaneous purchase and I can do it very quickly and easily. It's tied into my Apple account. I don't have to enter in my credit card information. You notice Steve Jobs mentions that in all of his keynotes when he's talking about how well Apple's doing in terms of sales. And now translate that stuff to some of the cloud conversations and rumors that we're hearing about this storage locker, this access to our media anytime, anywhere, after we've made the purchase. But there's also this concept of how do we get that media, how do we get that content, and how easy is that process? And if it's easy in and easy out, I think ultimately Apple's going to have an advantage. Consumers like that from an experience standpoint. I think developers are really going to like that, and content producers or providers are going to like that, because Apple's giving us easy access. They're making it almost too easy for us to open up our wallets and give money to Apple and the developers. And Apple's going to take their 30% of that, and I think they're going to be taking that all the way to the bank. So just something I was thinking about this week, and an amazing thing. I'd love to get your thoughts and opinions. If you know of another sort of environment where this is replicated, something similar that I just missed out on, let me know. Send your emails and your thoughts, comments to maccast@gmail.com. And I think that's going to do it for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to thank all of my show sponsors. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software as well as get free trials over at circusponies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label. Also, don't forget about Text Expander Touch, which is integrated with just more and more apps every day on the iOS devices. be it Twitter apps or text apps. Check that out, Text Expander Touch. You can get more information and details on all their products over at smilesoftware.com. And Phoronix, makers of Deep Freeze and PowerSave Mac. You can check out their stuff, get information as well as demos over at Phoronix.com. And a big thank you to all my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. I love hearing from you. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com or call in on the listener hotline, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. And if you do leave a voicemail, if you could leave your email address, that's greatly appreciated. If you'd like to leave a voicemail on Skype, I'm also there. My Skype address is the MacCast. And if you want to get links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the MacCast.com website. Also, while you're there, be sure to check out the MacCast forum. That's at forum.maccast.com. Great community of MacCast listeners who hang out and help each other out, answer questions, debate about stuff, talk about different stories and information that have happened during the week related to Apple and Mac and iOS and all the other products. So a lot of fun. And you should check that out if you haven't. Also, building up the community over on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast. I'm starting to post more links and videos and just more cool stuff that I run across during the week related to Mac and Apple. Actually, tonight, I just posted a video, a link to a video from a guy named who goes by the handle of iTrevor, this kid who actually dances at the Apple stores and videos it and puts it up on YouTube. So you'll find that there if you want to check that out. It's pretty cool. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. And that's all the ways to keep in touch with me virtually online between shows. The new music I have for you today comes from a recommendation from a MacCast listener. If you like the track, you like what you hear, I'll have a link to the artist's website in the show notes at maccast.com. And actually, this track is off a new album he just released on iTunes called 11th Hour. So if you like what you hear, you can support the artist by buying his music on iTunes. And I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com as well. So that's a great way to support these artists who make this music available to me to play for you for free. Now, I do need to let you know, this track, I usually try and keep all the tracks family-friendly and safe. This one does have a PG-level swear word in it, so if you're sensitive to that sort of thing, or if kids are around, then you don't want them to hear that. You probably want to shut off at this point, but for everyone else, this is Still Standing by John Briggs. Enjoy, and I will see you all next time.
Waking up, and I'm tired of making love, and I'm tired of saying shit that I don't mean, and I'm tired of feeling soft, and of calling your bluff, and of feeling like I'm so in between. Anything that I don't already have, and I don't need anything from you, 'cause I'd only give it all back. I'm tired of what you say, and of feeling this way, and of dreading every day except tomorrow. And I'm tired of breathing out, and of shutting my mouth, and of every bullet I have had to swallow. Anything I don't already have. tired of the guilt, and I'm tired of standing still, and I'm tired of everything making perfect sense.